Welcome to the Peter Moon Podcast, brought to you by Sky Books and the music of Noosa.
This is podcast number 6 on the subject of remote viewing. And in this podcast, we're going to finally arrive at techniques that people will be interested in as far as how to attain acumen at this sort of thing. But the first thing I want to say, and with reference to all of the earlier podcasts that we've done, it's the preparation is so important, because when I spoke, and what I'm going to be talking here is not Scientological. It's not about Scientology. Although, because Scientology was a foundational component of the government's remote viewing, I certainly couldn't dismiss the subject, and I'm not going to dismiss it here either, because I'm not saying that the techniques that were once a part of the upper levels of Scientology, I'm not saying that they weren't effective in that regard. In fact, many of the exercises that exist could be quite effective. And what I'm going to be talking about here is effective as well. It's a question of what in the hell works. And that was another foundational component of Scientology. What works? You don't do something if it doesn't work. Now, I stress the importance of taking inventory of the mind, seeing what's in the mind. And then once you, and that's interesting, because taking an inventory is akin to an audit in accounting. You're auditing the books. You're seeing what's in the books. And when you come to the field of remote viewing and the human mind, you're seeing what is in the mind. So you want to take an accounting of what's in the mind. And if you have bad merchandise inside of the mind, you want to clear it out.
How do you do that, though?
That's a good question. And as I said, Scientology dedicated itself to tomes of writings and information on how to do this.
Right.
And you can argue that it's effective or it's not effective. And many people would argue that it's not so effective today. I had great success with it, but that was in an earlier time period. But I'm going to state something because you asked that. And what I'm talking about here now is in the most recent book I did, The White Bat, The Alchemy of Writing.
Okay.
And The White Bat is a book which is a very amazing series of phenomena that happened in my own life. And it goes right to the core of what we're talking about here. But to answer your question, now, of course, how does one clear out their inventory? You can study the subject of psychology. You can study popular psychology. You can read all sorts of stuff. There's been all sorts of iterations about how to help you with your problems. And you can study Freud. You can study Carl Jung. I'm going to introduce you to a idea that is not a new idea, but it's called the dark room. And this is immersing yourself in complete darkness. Now, I'm going to explain, before I tell you how to clear that out, and address that question that you asked, which is a very relevant question, because in this technique, you can not only do what you just asked. Clear your mind, or you can also activate your paranormal perception. It's not really paranormal. It's really normal. But we refer to it as paranormal because most of the people in our current civilization look at this as paranormal. Now, we were mentioning in the previous podcast, podcast number 5, about this character named Vincent Bridges, who was all involved in Enochian magic and passed away last year in 2014. He made a very interesting comment on another one of his podcasts that I happened to catch. And he talked, and this goes right to the core of what we're talking about in darkness. I'm talking about a dark room. He talks about a process of Tibetan meditation, Tibetan monk meditation, whereby people would go into a cave for 3 years. Now, when I say people, I should say monks or aspirants of the Tibetan path. And basically, they would go into darkness, submerge themselves in darkness for 3 years.
Wow.
Now
you said aspirants. What's that?
Aspiring to higher consciousness.
Okay.
Aspiring to full enlightenment. In the Tibetan path, which people primarily in our culture associated with Buddhism, well, there were a lot of Buddhas or Bodhis before the character we know as Siddhartha Gautama appeared on the scene. He's the famous one that gets a lot of the credit, if not most or all. And there was the Bon tradition. So the Bons had a tradition called the Kala Chakra, which means the wheel of time. But the Buddhists adapted, co-opted, and utilized these ancient techniques and brought a new angle to it. We could call it a new spirit, and I don't mean to suggest that they improved upon anything. I'm not making a judgment here. I'm just saying that there's a more ancient tradition in Buddhism, but both of these traditions would embrace the idea of the cave and going in there for a long period of time. And as Vincent Bridges was saying, 3 years, of which the object was to emerge with what he called, very relevantly, a cascading of polypeptides. A polypeptide is just basically an amino acid. It's a piece of life inside of you.
Okay.
And poly is multiple. We're not going to go into biology here because that can confuse people, and we're going to talk a little bit about biology of the brain. But one can get lost in the biology. What we want is the functionality here. And the polypeptides are recognized for their as receptors. Now, there's an author, Candace Pert, and she talks about polypeptides as a turning point in mind-body medicine. She wrote a book called Molecules of Emotion, and she's a PhD. What she said is she was linking the objective and the subjective with her proof that physiology and emotions are inseparable. Over the years, she found that peptides act as signaling molecules in the brain, but also that white blood cells, bone marrow cells, yes, even cells in endocrine organs have receptors for these peptides. So they're influencing the whole body. And the bone marrow cells are very relevant when we get to the subject of what I'm dealing with, and that's Qigong, which means bone marrow washing. The implication is that what goes on in the mind affects the physical health of the whole body, starting with the brain, endocrine, and immune systems. Now, when the Tibetan aspirant, monk, whatever you want to call him, he comes out of the cave, he's had this epiphany, this moment of enlightenment. What it means is he's a whole hell of a lot more aware of himself and circumstances than he was before he went in the cave. 3 years is a long time to be in the cave.
Right.
In the ancient tradition of Dasha, which the land we now know as Transylvania, which is within the political border of Romania, current-day Romania, the ancient god Zalmoxis went into the caves for 4 years. He did a 4-year program. And he graduated from that program according to tradition of becoming, transcending from a human being to a god. And god might mean immortal. And he became an inspiration for religions we know today as Judaism, Christianity, the Persian religion, Zoroastrianism. And he was a foundational component of many mysteries that, he's not that well recognized by routine scholarship. But this is another important part of, and I mentioned the Zalmoxis thing, 4 years as opposed to 3 years, because there is an ancient connection between Tibet and the land in Transylvania. In other words, they were repositories of ancient civilizations. And there is still a tradition in both locations today of an ancient consciousness that was there and is still there. And although this sounds like it's a bit off topic, it's really not, because we're talking about an ancient technique. And the idea of this enlightenment and linking the physiology to the emotions is all tied into how you feel. And of course, you can't dismiss the spirit or the mind. Now, to get back to your question and to compare it to, I'm not going to suggest that anybody go into a cave for 3 or 4 years.
Right.
What are you going to come out with? This is not something I would recommend unless you're really a unique individual and are really driven to do this for some reason. It's not practical for most people. What I'm talking about is a procedure called the dark room, which I learned about in my adventures through my 20 plus years of writing. And that I learned from Grandmaster Roosevelt Ganey of the Taoist System of Living Arts. And this is the dark room, which is a short procedure, relatively easy procedure. The hardest part of the procedure is having the discipline to do it. And I'm going to give you an example here. I'm trying to find a script to read from here.
Okay.
As I look for this, the first part is to find a room that you can find of complete darkness. And darkness means, like, I happen to have a pantry in my house, which is really most functional for a dark room. Take out the cupboards. It's underneath the staircase, and the hardest part of the dark room in my particular house is to get the cracks out. to get the cracks of light coming in. Now, if you do it early in the morning or late at night, you don't have, and just turn off the lights, you don't have to worry about this problem because it's dark. If it's light outside, I put pieces of newsprint into the cracks. My teacher, who lives in a different situation, in a high-rise building in Coney Island, he told me he uses his entire bedroom, but he uses thick army blankets over the windows to cover it. So another one of my fellow students used a bathroom, and because he was living in probably a relatively small apartment, but the bathroom he could make dark.
Do you do this every day? Is it like for an hour, for 2 hours?
I'll get to that. I haven't thought of that. So anyway, I have this exercise delineated very clearly in this book, The White Bat, The Alchemy of Writing, which is available at skybooksusa.com or on Amazon. It's also available in ebook format from Kindle, Nook, and iTunes. Okay, the first step is find yourself a dark room, completely dark. Use a towel, dark tape, or whatever to get rid of the cracks. Army blanket for large windows. Walk-in closets are good. Pantries, regular closets, hallways, or even a bathroom. And this is the first step that can be very challenging, is find yourself a dark room. If one was in a particularly challenging situation, I've seen there are other devices where, you know, like there used to be something called an orgone box that I've been in. An orgone box was to generate energy, life energy, orgone being life energy. They used to sell those things, the Wilhelm Reich techniques. But that could be dark. So there are many ways to find darkness, but this is the first obstacle. And if one was really super challenged, one might have to use the evening as part of their construct. Now, that's step zero, find a dark room. Step one is go inside, and this answers your question, go inside the dark room for 15 minutes a day. Sit or stand if you like. Relax. Sit up straight. Elongate your neck at the shoulders so that you have correct posture. Now, this next thing I'm going to tell you, which is a part of step one, is a way to clean out your inventory. Scan downward from the crown of your head to the toes. Scan downwards. Always scan downwards. Don't scan upwards. And when you scan, you're using your imagination.
Right.
You're clearing away your mental, emotional, and physical blockages or disabilities. Now, this is very powerful. Most people will not get this far. If you understand what it takes, the discipline it takes to sit down and say, I'm going to scan, I'm going to imagine, like just like a computer scanner or a scanner that you'd use in conjunction with a computer, you're going to scan down. Instead of scanning a document, well, you're scanning a document that consists of a lot of DNA inside of you. You're scanning down from the top of your head. This includes not only all the chakras, but it's a how you perceive yourself. And when you do this, and you do it honestly, you're going to have stuff come up. You might find that your neck's a little stiff. You might find out that there's all sorts of things. Now, you're going to do this two or three times a day, but for 15 minutes at a time. And this is just step one. You're scanning down. You're clearing yourself out. And the fact that somebody might feel, well, I'm just imagining that I'm doing it. Well, you know what? That's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to imagine. You break down the word imagine. It's I-mage. I-mage. Madge is like the word for magus. It's like a magician. You're being a magician. You're being somebody who works wonders. You're being somebody, and this is what remote viewing is about, is working wonders. But this is between you and the interface with the world. And this is why when this Dr. Candace Pert is talking about physiology and the emotions being inseparable, well, here's your emotions. How do you feel about this? You know, how do you feel about your head? How do you feel about your neck? How do you feel about your mouth? How do you feel about the rest of your anatomy? And this is the Scientology techniques in this department had a lot to do with creating your emotions and emulating, you know, really feeling what your emotions were and creating them and uncreating them at will. That might apply to sexuality. It might apply to base emotions. It might apply to your interactions with other people. But the thing was, is when a person can go inside of their own head, I'm not talking about going inside of somebody else's head, and create or uncreate that emotion. Like suppose you hate some particular movie star, or you hate some particular sports team or celebrity. You feel that hatred. Why do you hate them? Well, you know, you all know that hating something like that is kind of a game. You really have to hate them. Is it really that important, you know, to hate the L.A. Dodgers or New York Yankees or whoever you hate? Is it really that big of a deal? Or the movie star that gets too much press and too much attention on the wrong thing? These reality shows that they have with these people that they pay too much attention to, do you have to hate them? In other words, can you create that emotion of hate you have for them, and is it really all that serious?
Because it doesn't make sense.
Well, it's you know, we have predispositions to feeling some ways, and these things can be genuinely offensive to our sensibilities. Yeah. Might be better to turn off the TV or not look at the internet, but whatever it is, you're trying to come into control of your own emotions and being cause over your emotions, who is causing what? So that's just sort of a sidebar as far as the Scientology approach. But what I'm saying is you're scanning your entire body, and that includes your mental, your emotion, and your physicality. And what you're doing in the dark room is, and this is, as they say, I didn't learn about the polypeptides from Candace Pert or from studying Tibet or from Vincent Bridges. I learned about them from my teacher. I mean, they're part of physiology and the human anatomy. But he pointed out to me and our class, the polypeptides are what you're activating, your receptor cells, your ability to receive in your physical body. I will go, and your physical body is connected to your emotions in your mental body. So anyway, step one is doing this scanning exercise. Step two, you're going to be going into the dark room two or three times a day, 15 minutes, and you're going to be completely still. That's step two. Do this for 1 week. Step two is going in and be completely still. So the first point you're scanning, you do this for a week, three times a day, stuff's going to come up. You do it step two, and you're going to be completely still. Now, you're going to see stuff when you go in that dark room. In the previous podcast, I talked about or read from the warning from the back cover,
right,
which talked about the mirror of your own reality, which includes your wildest dreams and their fulfillment, but also your greatest nightmares. Well, you go in the darkness. Why are little children sometimes afraid of the dark? Why are grown-ups sometimes afraid of the dark? Why would people procrastinate and not try this exercise if they were interested in the subject? Or if they were told that it's going to improve their consciousness. You're going in and you're facing your own cobwebs. And anybody who doesn't have cobwebs in their psyche is
full of crap.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it, because they would be a much far brighter shining example of humanity than they otherwise are. So before I go to step three, because you really have to do these. It would be more instructive to, you know, tell everybody, sit down with a bunch of people and say, okay, you're going to get a dark room, and actually have dark rooms. I mean, in the Scientology days, they'd have I remember there was a garage which was full of constructed auditing rooms, you know, probably about 10 of them. And people could go in and they'd be full. If you were an auditor, you'd have to reserve one. I'd have to reserve my student auditing sessions that I was giving during the lunch or dinner hours when nobody was using them. So, because they were usually full. So if I had a room full of that dark rooms, and I, you know, say a class of 10 people, and I'd say, okay, well, you don't have to worry about step zero. We got a dark room for you. Go in there for 15 minutes. Elongate your neck, sit it with your shoulders straight. You're going to scan down for 15 minutes. And everybody comes out and say, okay, what happened with you? What happened with you? That actually offers a support group of a result to where people start talking about it. And somebody might say, well, I wasn't doing it very good. Or somebody might have been, I was doing it real good. And people inspire each other in such a situation. And then they do that for a week every day, three times a day. Now, when we talk about the polypeptides, which was the great, what those Tibetan monks or aspirants would have looked forward to, was the polypeptides becoming receiving. They're receiving information from their entire physiology, which means all of those parts of the brain that might not otherwise be working so well. That there's something in the human body that is not well understood in terms of functionality. And although it's recognized by medicine, and I've recently learned there's a whole institute towards studying it in Denver, it's the subject of fascia, F-A-S-C-I-A, F-A-S-C-I-A. I'm not talking about the CIA, Central Intelligence Agency, but, you know, it's a funny word, fascia.
Yeah,
it is the Central Intelligence Agency of the body. It really is. The fascia is your connective tissue. And if you open a chicken, you know, one that's uncooked, and you see all that, how do you describe it, fabric of the chicken that kind of holds everything together in the chicken.
Right, the skin.
Well, it's not the skin. It's what's underneath the skin. It's, right. It's stuff you pull at, and it's like sort of like elastic, but it's not elastic. It's underneath the skin. That's the fascia. It ties everything together. Now, the fascia is full of polypeptides. The fascia is literally your connective tissue, and it all emanated when you grew up from a baby. It all emanated from the navel. And the navel was your original brain. There have been some studies that will show that there's another brain in the solar plexus or by the navel. Well, I'm not talking about those. Also, there's a brain in the heart. But the navel is your original, where you originated from. And everything out of the body grew out of the umbilical area.
Right.
That was what sustained you in the pre-birth state. It's where you originated from. Now, that fascia is a central intelligence of its own because it extended out from it into the realm. It The brain is an extension of the navel. The eyes are an extension of the navel. The toes, the appendages, the fingers, it all started in the navel. Why, when you get nervous, do you have a feeling in your gut? The butterflies, you feel the butterflies in your navel more than you do your heart or your head.
The center of gravity is around that area.
Exactly. Oh. And you can imagine, you know, most people haven't had either the opportunity or the misfortune to get in the ring with a boxer, but you can imagine what these guys feel when they're in a challenging fight. It's not an easy opponent. You can imagine they got somebody ready to knock their block off, and you can imagine how they feel down there in that gut area.
Thank you for listening to the Peter Moon Podcast. To purchase Peter's books, visit skybooksusa.com. Also visit Peter's blog, digitalmontauk.com.
And to hear more music by Noosa, visit noosasounds.com.
Welcome to the Peter Moon Podcast, brought to you by Sky Books and the music of Noosa.
All right, so here we are, podcast number 6, part 2. We were discussing fascia and how it relates to the dark room. And we're talking about the fascia is all emanating from the navel. And the navel is the core of where you came from. Now, in Qigong, it is right at the top of what is called the Qi belt. And the Qi belt, if you can pull in your navel and lift your anus, you will feel, this will be your first feeling of what the Qi belt is. You'll feel stronger down there. And that triangle that goes from the tip of that triangle would be the bottom of your pubic region, comes up in a triangle up in the crease between your thighs and your groin, right along your groin, up, and then the base of the triangle, which is upside down, is going to come right across where your navel is. This is where your chi originates or comes into the body. And it's a better way to say it. Now, when you have this chi belt on, as they say, the chi belt is, people have tried to break down the chi belt into an anatomical piece of stuff, but it's not really. It's a function. It's a belt that you put on. It's an imaginary belt, but it's really, it has a result. And two of the results, and particularly in the initial stages, is your anus is going to be lifted and your navel is going to be pulled in. Now, where this becomes very functional, arm wrestle somebody with that chi belt on and see how much stronger you are than if you arm wrestle them without it on.
Really?
You wouldn't believe the difference. There'd be people you could beat with it on that you could not beat if you didn't have it on. And this is easily demonstrable. Like in class, we will often have a lady. She could be a relatively new student. She puts her chi belt on and you have two big guys trying to hold her down.
Yeah.
And she puts that chi belt on and she can stand up and she'll walk with them, dragging them.
Huh.
It's that It's that demonstrative. It's that simple. And there are all sorts of techniques which is just focusing on the body. And it makes one much stronger. It makes them more powerful. Because what you're doing is you're linking all the fascia together. And all those polypeptides are working in harmony. It's harmonizing the body. But the fascia, again, goes throughout the entire body. Now, when I say to scan down, you're scanning through your mental, emotional, and physical body. So, what's there? Any time one is injured, if the first impression is on the fascia. And if the fascia is not conditioned or strong, and in most people, it will rip like a chicken because their fascia is not strong, it's not built up. Now, you've heard of a malady, and you hear about it in sports from time to time, but particularly with older people, plantar fasciitis. This is like a heel spur. It's a heel spur.
Okay.
And you get this hard condition in the back of the heel. I had it myself over 10 years ago. And you go to a podiatrist, they'll give you a lift, what do you call it, an insert, and it's a just like a big block, and it doesn't work too well. And then there was an Italian had invented these inserts. It was a place called the Good Feet Store, whereby the inserts were flexible and they were higher. So they would do for you what a podiatrist could not do for you and would not do for you. Now, I don't know if podiatry has cleaned up their act since then, but they used to fight this thing. And, you know, I learned about this from my brother-in-law and my sister who had similar issues. I got one of these things and I was fixed and I was so bad I couldn't play football. I was fixed in a week. I was fine. Hmm. And I wore that insert until I started doing the Qigong, and then I didn't need it anymore because I'm constantly conditioning my fascia. Now, that in that particular case, what happens with plantar fasciitis and is you have a condition that's on the foot, sort of in the arch of the foot, and there's a certain tendon area that's not being stimulated. So it's not getting enough action, it begins to tense up the back of the heel.
Yes.
So you feel like your heel. And so when you begin to have this insert that's high and it's a flexible insert and it's bopping that thing, all of a sudden your foot can walk again.
Huh.
Your foot feels, wow. Well, I do so much stimulation with the Qigong by just walking in a figure eight every day that condition is just not going to happen to me. I had a friend that I played sports with in high school, and he's still my friend to this day. And he was telling me that he couldn't do sports anymore because he had the plantar fasciitis. I told him what to do. In fact, I did not even tell him to go to the Good Feet Store. I told him how to roll a ball on his foot. This will put you to sleep at night. You roll a ball on your foot for 5 minutes on each foot, 1 minute on, 1 minute off. You do alternate the feet, 5 minutes each. And that got rid of his condition. I mean,
I've never even heard of this. I mean, some of these things seem so, well, they are ancient things like Qigong and the exercises, but it's not common knowledge to most people.
It's not common knowledge, and because doctors, by and large, do not have the common knowledge of these things, they will use what they're familiar with, and they can miss this stuff. Then it also can get into bad news where doctors or institutions will sometimes, like I have a friend who's a chiropractor, and I was just with him this morning, and he told me that he was approached by MRI facilities whereby there's a law where doctors cannot get a cut, a what a kickback. They can't get kickbacks.
Right.
So they offered him $100 under the table for every time he'd send somebody to an MRI facility. These things cost big bucks, you know.
Yeah.
And just to put you under a machine and exert a little bit of electricity with a readout. But he wouldn't do it because he said, this is ethics. This is like, you know, I learned this in ethics. Now, he's got a big practice, huge practice. He doesn't need the extra $100. Would it come in handy? Sure it would. But recently there was a doctor on Long Island who was prosecuted for having some form of kickback, which actually was in the interest of the patient and the insurance company, everybody, if he would be allowed to have the kickback. In this particular case, it wasn't for MRIs. But the problem is, well, anyway, the point of it is that doctors will sometimes be put in a position or take the position to do things, be induced into doing things for monetary benefit.
Sure.
And this is something that...
And to sell medicine.
Exactly. So, but really, the problem is they're not apprised of this. The president of the Arthritis Trust, it's called, who is a friend of mine, told me that when I had a friend who had needed a like a hip replacement.
Okay.
He dug up information, sent it to me. Copies of it that show this is in medical journals where they have techniques from ancient Greece to tell you how to avoid a hip replacement, why you don't need a hip replacement. Now, Qigong can help somebody with a bad hip like that, and it's not hard. But the techniques, and I don't remember what they are offhand, but the point was is that he said, oh, yeah, this is in medical journals. The doctors can use it, but they don't do it because there's big bucks involved in replacing somebody's hip.
Sure.
So, in any case, to get back to this whole thing I was talking about was the fascia. And the fascia goes throughout your entire body. And when you get, like, say, for example, when somebody hits you in the arm,
right,
and it hurts, it's not just a tap, it hurts.
Yeah.
That's your fascia, your receptive cells reacting, and it hurts.
Yeah.
When your fascia is conditioned, it doesn't hurt so much. And one of there are many ways, and this is an offshoot from the dark room, but you'll see that it's very important to what we're talking about, because this is not just the receptor cells on the physical level. But I will give you an example. I was standing, doing Qigong standing for years, 20 minutes a day. You're standing with your body, your knees slightly bent, like you're holding an imaginary beach ball. And it's not easy to keep your hands extended like that, like you're holding an imaginary ball for 20 minutes every day.
Yeah.
Well, after you do it, what you're doing is you're fatiguing the muscle and you're strengthening the tendons. You're strengthening the fascia. You're strengthening the fascia throughout the entire body. You're also sending a message to your body that you are not subservient to the body. The body is going to pay attention. Now, if you can imagine or accept the proposition that your body and all of the genetic information knows from way back in the beginning of time, where all this the genus of your genes came from, it can respond and have sort of a respect for what you're actually doing. If you're going back and learning ancient techniques, you can imagine or postulate that there's a certain respect that the body will recognize and that you are directing it towards a more original or holistic way of existing. And the body has a tendency to be kinder to you than it otherwise might if you were feeding it toxic food,
right,
or subjecting it to toxic conditions. The body's like a pet animal in a lot of ways. So just for an example of how powerful this, I've been standing for years. And then one time, I was 59 at the time, and I was on the football field, and I went up to make a catch on the sidelines. It was going to be a very good catch, which I was fully capable of making. You jump in, you have 1 foot going into the inbounds. And some young guy, about 19 years old, slams me from the back. I'm blindsided. I don't see him coming. I dropped the ball. And everybody, and it was a fully legal hit. This was not an illegal hit. We're playing touch football, but you can go for the ball and hit the person.
Yeah.
And everybody sort of looked at him like, what in the hell are you doing? You did not need to do this. In other words, like, you know, he's much younger than I am. Why is he doing this? And what the hell had happened to me? And I got right up, and it didn't even faze me.
Right.
I said, no, and everybody expected me to be really hurt. I said, no, I'm not hurt. I'm fine. Now, what had that happened 5, 7, 10 years earlier? What would have happened is I would have been hit, and where I got hit, which probably would have been the back of the ribs, would have all kind of crinkled down, would have kind of just like had a spasm, a quick spasm, like boom. And the internal organs inside of me would have kind of shriveled up. That's what they do. They shrivel up when you get the wind knocked out of you.
Yeah.
And I would have fallen down, and I would have been out of breath, and I would have been hurting, assuming I didn't have any broken ribs. And I might not have been able to play that day or for weeks. And in any case, I would have been out for at least 20 minutes. And that is the difference of having your fascia strong and having it conditioned by standing still. Okay? Because the fascia is no longer loose and floppy. It's tight, and it responds accordingly. So this is – now, when we get into the more esoteric idea of the fascia, the fascia is not just a physical thing. There's fascia that extends outward into the universe. The universe has a fabric to it. So you could, if you have enough ability to...
Like the fabric of time.
Yes, space-time, yes, yes. So, and this ties into concepts like dark energy. Dark energy is, to put it very simply, is the energetic matrix of the universe, which we don't understand. The scientists will tell you there's only a small part of the universe that we understand. The rest of it is dark energy, for a very simplistic explanation. So the fascia extends into the entire ecosphere and beyond. So this is... One is connecting to infinity in this procedure. Now, we've gone step one, which was the scanning. Step two was stillness. Step three is joint manipulation. This is moving your body in whatever way it wants to move, getting the kinks out of the system, and you're breathing in through the nose, exhaling through the mouth as you do this, slow as possible. This is, again, done 2 or 3 times a day, 15 minutes each. Now, the joint manipulation unites the fascia. And there are so, like, I from the first day I learned joint manipulation, and I did it in this dark room, there's so much you can learn about it. It sounds very simple, but it gets the kinks out. But as you learn, the joints are not well understood. I'm currently doing exercises for the joints that puts blood into the joints. And when you get blood flowing and you get the joints moving, and this is what joint manipulation is about, somebody can wake up in the morning, drink a glass of water with a little bit of lemon in it, and start doing joint manipulation first thing in the morning in the bed. Boy, this does wonders for you, for your whole body, because you're moving your body in ways it's not going to move when it's up. You're conditioning your body. This is very healthy for the body, particularly when people get older. But when you get into more learned states of joint manipulation, and your arthritis isn't going to exist in a joint that's working. Arthritis is like rust. And this stuff can be alleviated so easily. But if you tell a person these things, they're generally not going to have the mental fortitude. And I don't think there's any remote viewing advocate in the world, many of which I would probably have issues with, but that's beside the point. I don't think they would disagree that this practice requires a great deal of mental fortitude. So that the average person who's complaining of their situation, they probably will not have the mental fortitude to do this. Some will, and some do, and they get better. And so the mind, and even the average physician will tell you that the mental outlook and attitude is very important, and that exercise is very important. But this isn't just ordinary exercise. This is going into darkness, and you're manipulating your joints, and you're getting all the fascia to work together, and you're getting the body to work together. Now, this is uniting a body-mind-soul connection. Step four, this is the fourth week, you're in complete darkness, and you have freedom to do whatever you want in that darkness. Here you have freedom, two or three times a day. This is step four. And I'm going to talk more about how all of this works. But as they say, step five is most people will not get this far. And if you do get that far, in the book I say, well, contact me. I give the email at the beginning of the book, which is skybooks@yahoo.com.
Right.
And anybody who gets this far can write to me and while you're on step four and see what you're going to do next. I did have one person do this, get that far. Now, when I did these exercises, and there's variations on these exercises, but this was very specifically given to us. And when I came back to him for step five, he says, you're the only one who's ever done this. And what happened to me when I did step five, not that step five is any great secret, but what happened to me of the accumulation, I began to, while I'm in the complete darkness, get a whole life review. You've heard of a life review just when, before you die, you see your whole life go before your life,
right.
Eyes.
Yeah.
Well, this wasn't quite like that, but it wasn't unlike that either, because I had to review every major situation and decision I was involved in. And what I, like in other words, should I drop everything and become an airline pilot? Should I go off and work in the African jungles like Albert Schweitzer did? This was a moment of life-changing epiphany territory.
Thank you for listening to the Peter Moon Podcast. To purchase Peter's books, visit skybooksusa.com. Also visit Peter's blog at digitalmontauk.com.
And to hear more music by Noosa, visit noosasounds.com.
Welcome to the Peter Moon Podcast, brought to you by Sky Books and the music of Noosa.
During the fifth step was that I got a life review. Somewhat similar to when you hear that your life is about to end and it flies before you. Well, it wasn't quite like that, but it wasn't altogether different, and that I basically realized that I could change direction and change my whole life if it was warranted, but it was not warranted. I was on course. I was living out my life's purpose as I saw fit or as that I wanted to do. So, but had I been in a different position or a different circumstance, I could have changed it and rearranged it. And recently, this has been a focal point in my life. I have had to change a lot of things in my life. And I have been doing the dark room more than I've ever done it. And not necessarily in these procedural steps, which is how I started it. But the dark, being in the darkness is to connect you to basically yourself and all the gaps in Qigong, which means bone marrow washing or breath work. Breath work, you're connecting. In Qigong, you're connecting gaps. When you move through the air with a movement, you can imagine just like you'd see a Tai Chi person moving. It's no different. You're moving, and you're moving slow as possible because you're connecting between all those instances of movement, all those many instances of movement as you move your hands and your legs. You're filling the gaps. You're occupying literally the fabric of space and time, the fascial fabric of space and time. When I say you're moving the fascia of the body, but also the fascia of the space-time itself. And that's what you're doing by moving in a very slow, slow, methodical way. So when you go into the darkness, you're connecting your mind, your body, yourself, or your spirit, but you're also connecting with the universe. And you're connecting, you're integrating yourself with the entirety of the universe. And this is a very Taoist approach. You're not excluding things. You're taking care of what comes up. Now, that's procedure number one, darkroom. And that will help one clear out one's mind. And then it can always repeat this. If you didn't get one step or something's bugging you, you can go back and do it and clear the mind. What can come up in the dark room can be quite fascinating to an individual. And the more one can tap into, the more interesting it is. Now, one of the things you're doing in darkness, and we're talking about the cascading of polypeptides, which is your receptor, again, your receptor cells. You're trying to receive information from the universe. Of course, doing this in darkness is going to help you receive what you might need to know or want to know that's outside the bounds of your normal mail that you get in the mailbox or the mail that you get in your email. This will extend beyond that. Now, one of the things you're doing in any sort of operation that includes what could be termed remote viewing is you're stimulating the visual cortex. And the visual cortex is a very underappreciated word in our world. And
is that like a pineal gland?
No.
Okay.
The visual cortex is in the back of the brain. You can look it up on Wikipedia. It'll show you where it is.
Okay.
Now, it's part of the brain that's where visio is processed. Now, there's a visual cortex on the left side of the brain, which receives input from the right side of the brain. And there's a visual cortex on the right side, which it receives input from the left. And essentially, and a priori to this, it comes from the retina. But the visual cortex is not relegated to only receiving input from the retina. It receives input from other sources. And dreaming is one of these sources. Now, when you think of the fabric of dreams, wow, where do dreams come from? Now, when you talk about receiving input from other sources than the retina, we're talking about polypeptides. We're talking about the receptor cells of the body. It could come from any part of the human body and any experience of the human body. Further, so many structures of the body, the DNA, serve as antennas. So you could be having 100th monkey effects between parts of your body and parts of somebody else's body that are completely mysterious to ordinary observation. But in any case, the visual cortex has the potential to be stimulated by the entire infinite stream of what's out there, especially if you can connect the fascia, the concept of the fascia, to energetic fascia, which would go out into dark matter itself. So being that the visual cortex is a station point which is fed information and which presents a screen for a person to look at, that's where you're going to get your core remote viewing experience when you have something out of the ordinary. And it may manifest in different ways to different people. But when we talk about the visual cortex in the ordinary stream of consciousness and politics, and I talk about politics, and I'm not talking about government politics, I'm talking about the politics to get at your visual cortex. Now, words and illustrations on a paper stimulate the visual cortex. Writing and art do that. The Bible is an example of having your visual cortex stimulated.
Music.
Yes, but I'm going to stick to the Bible here because it illustrates the politics. When somebody reads the Bible, their visual cortex is stimulated in different ways, with some commonalities in between. When an evangelist or minister preaches about the second coming or revelation, he's stimulating the visual cortex to his congregation, of his congregation, based upon what has already been stimulated inside of himself. Now, when you come to this sort of subject in Christianity, you have a disparity of opinions, even by people who consider themselves to be Christians. And if you can stimulate the visual cortex in a more persuasive way, depending upon the prejudices of a particular audience, you can attract more adherents. So you see, this instrument called the Bible is all about stimulating the visual cortex. It was collated and edited in such a way as to do exactly that and to create a certain response or responses, commonly called the divinely inspired word of God, writing from faith.
That gets back to what we were talking about in podcast number 5 about the structure and phrasing of words.
Well, yes, but in this context here, it's a little more directed towards a physical earth situation of people trying to persuade you by stimulating your visual cortex. This is what happens in advertising.
Yeah.
Or, you know, they used to put the subliminal advertising. Oh, I want Coca-Cola.
Yep.
Now, the Bible on the outside is trying to integrate mankind with divinity. And how good a job it does is highly debatable. And you can have all sorts of different opinions here. But the point of it is that the visual cortex is stimulated in a meaningful way. Whether you like the meaning or it's a good meaning or bad meaning is a whole different issue, and it can often lead to being the visual cortex can not just in religion but can be stimulated so as to unground the individual. So the person's like, you know, seeing hallucinations. He's become too zealous about something. He's suffered from overstimulation of the visual cortex. This is why the dark room is good, because it enables you to scan down and clear out all of that dross or gook or whatever you want to call it. So you're going in the darkness, and ultimately you're going to be your own filter anyway. So you can, you know, if you want to go in there and just filter out what is applicable and not applicable to your life, you're the one who's deciding.
It's I wish more choice. People would do that.
Well, that's the whole idea here. This is the whole idea. You are your own intermediary with the archetypal forces of creation. And willful lucid dreaming does the whole thing here. So, you know, you have all sorts of politics surrounding the control or stimulation of people's visual cortex. So this is one way, because we've been talking about this for several podcasts, and I tried to show that there's a whole context that has to be accounted for here before I even want to discuss the possibility or probability of somebody having some degree of success with this endeavor. There's a lot of minefields out there, but the ultimate minefield is yourself and your own mind-body interface. And the dark room gives an example. Any questions?
No, you've given great examples, and you've certainly warned people of the dangers of trying remote viewing, but it sounds to me like people should buy the White Bat and read that and learn the steps, just be cautious in how they proceed.
Well, that's a nice advertisement, and I thank you for that. But that's one way to go. And I would also state that this particular book, The White Bat, is all based upon stimulation of my own visual cortex that happened in 1989 when I had a dream. Now, the result, that dream was arguably the result of a lot of remote viewing exercises I had been doing, which I won't even go into, because the ones I've just given you are far superior.
Yeah.
However, and they were not from Scientology, by the way, but all of that would eventually, apparently, in a lot of the reading of alchemy that I had done in the works of Aleister Crowley, had resulted in this dream of me being in Dracula's castle and actually chasing him at sunset, grabbing onto him as he turned into a bat, and then he turned into a white bat. And from the white bat, he turned into Dracula in white, and he identified himself as the opposite of Dracula. In other words, Christ, Antichrist, Antichrist, Christ. And that dream was so profound, I wrote it down. I typed it up. And I wrote a story, a short story that was based upon the dream. Showed it to my wife. She loved it. A few people who ever saw it liked it. But this was 1989. I was writing. I tried to get it published, was not successful. I started on a book about Atlantis, because I figured, well, everybody wants to read about Atlantis. They always have. Those books have always sold. Well, writing about Atlantis led me to the Montauk Project, which can be arguably called old Atlantean technology based upon an old Atlantean mountain known as Montauk Point, because it is the top of a mountain geologically. So basically, that dream was a precursor. Like I don't know if I should say my receptor cells, as dramatized through my own visual cortex, had some sort of idea that I was going to go to Romania. And the only way my connection could be to Romania, the only Romanian connection I understood after reading the New York Times and finding out that Transylvania was in Romania, not Hungary, little did I know. I write about that in the book. That I was being slated to go to Romania. But this dream was in 1989. I would not go to Romania for 19 years after that. And then after going there 6 or 7 times, I finally decided that, you know what, after I published all these books on Romania, I should resurrect this story, which I did, and I'm going to write a story about the white bat and talk about, hey, wow, I had this dream that I was in Romania, and that I was being called. So I get to Romania in 2013, and I'm going to be, I meet our guide who's going to take us to the holy area, and he tells me, I'm telling him, to a group of his friends, it's being translated into Romanian, that I said I was being pulled to your country by this dream I had of a white bat, and he got very excited, and later that day introduced me to a girl who'd seen a white bat in a cave just a few days before. So I said, wow, I have my story. I've completed my journey. Wow. This was en route. Well, I was going on a quest to find the Valley of the Golden Thrones, which I did find, which was mentioned in the book, The Secret Parchment, the great mysterious Valley of the Golden Thrones, where all this huge gold is underneath the ground. Well, I was already there. I didn't realize I was in the valley. It took a process of several questions and answering and very adept interpretation by myself to understand that we were indeed in the Valley of the Golden Thrones. And of course, this is an area of superconsciousness. And I say superconsciousness because gold is a superconductor. So basically, whatever work I was doing at that time was stimulating my visual cortex, and it led to a remarkable experience 19 years later, or maybe it was 17 or 18, but where I had this, I found out that there's a whole species of white bats in Transylvania that's not even in regular zoology. I was shown pictures of them. So this is a rather, I guess what I'd say, life-embracing experience that I had with this. And it's even far more deeper than I can even get across in this, as we wind down this particular interview. It's far more wide embracing. I do discuss some of it in the book, a lot of it in the book, but it also has a sequel to it, which may not ever find its way into writing, but nevertheless is. The whole idea here is when somebody hears about remote viewing, they get excited, they say, wow, that's neat. Wow. And then people take courses and they say, oh, this is real. It's real. You can do it. I don't know where their excitement comes from. They've had success with it. Maybe they have. But they get awfully sophomoric in their excitement. And then you find them a couple years later and they don't have anything to do with remote viewing. Because life swallows you up.
Right.
Life swallows you up, and or it can swallow you up, and this is one of the challenges. So one can follow a road. One can follow a path. What's much more important than one's acumen in remote viewing is what the darkroom can deliver for one in terms of who are you in life and what are you doing and where are you going. Now, your remote viewing abilities may complement that or they may detract from it, depending on if you're getting distracted by looking into things that you shouldn't be looking into. As a great example of that is in the movie The Lord of the Rings, when the hobbits, the character named Pippin, he looks into the crystal ball and he sees the Dark Master, the Dark Lord, and he almost discombobulates the entire adventure because he's looking into something that not only should he not be looking into it, he's not capable because that darkness will swallow him whole. Mm-hmm. And it almost does. So that's a great example of what are you looking into? What are you going out onto the extra parameters of existence and looking at? What are you looking at this stuff for?
Yeah. Well, it's good advice to just know yourself before you pursue anything like this, because you don't know what's going to come up.
Important, and that's what the old mystery schools used to have over the doors. When you enter the temple, know thyself. To thine own self be true, know thyself, which were also words used in the New Testament. So this is important. And then this is so important because so much of what you see out there is by people who are advocating far less than that. And this is a situation and a problem. And many people have to go through it the hard way, and they have to do stupid things and follow stupid people to learn not to be stupid. And this is just part of life. It's, you know, sometimes you can help them by warning them, and sometimes they have to go through the experience themselves.
But some people just don't learn.
That's true. So you originally came to me in your quest to find out about remote viewing. So we've got here is 6 podcasts, some of which are quite lengthy and broken into separate parts. And I have to ask you, has your attention, at least for the time being, been satisfied on this question?
Definitely. Sure has. It's not something that I want to actually... I don't know if I actually want to do it now. I don't know if it's coming out right.
No, it comes out perfect. You make perfect sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, I was just fascinated by it.
It is fascinating. It is fascinating subject, and I think everything we've discussed has been fascinating.
Oh, definitely. And, you know, I was just still fascinated with the whole Inga Swan thing and the dark side of the moon. I'm still fascinated by that whole thing. But if I was, like you said early on when we first started talking about this, you know, when you start doing remote viewing, how the hell do you know what it is you're actually seeing?
Well, yes, and you can obtain certainty on this by honing your skills. But the whole thing it comes down to is, you know, and as I'm not saying this to you, but to anybody, including myself, who the hell are you and what the hell are you doing?
Yeah.
And in this... in this quest for whatever your questing is, whether it be remote viewing, but what do you want to do with this information? What do you want to do with it? And this becomes a very, very important issue. Now, I've also got other issues in that book, The White Bat, which you have a copy of, that give further exercises on how to clean out your inventory. This is like writing, and there are other ways in there to improve. And the whole idea, and what that book has done, has inspired people to actually write. And the whole idea of writing, by the way, it's called The Alchemy of Writing. the whole idea of writing is not to make everybody a writer or an author, but it's to integrate the left and the right side of the brain. The left side being the logical linear side, which writes, and the right side being the creative side, which is creative and nonlinear. So when you integrate the two, and it's very good to write to get an expression of what is going on in your life. And this is the whole idea of the book, is to get one expressing themselves in life in the way that they are meant to be. You are a musician. If you read this book, I think it would make you a more conscious musician, mm-hmm. or a more conscious web designer, whatever it is that you're doing right now or that you want to do. If you don't want to do music, that's a different thing. But it's, how are you here on this earth to express yourself, and what are you going to do, and how are you going to do it? This becomes far more important than chasing an exotic story or an exotic idea, which might be interesting, but it might not. It might not, in the end, serve one, as many people have given up on their exotic pursuits of phenomena.
Right. Well, that makes a lot of sense.
Or their pursuits of exotic phenomena.
It's so interesting to learn about it, though. In our couple of our discussions, I believe in podcast 5, talking about the occult matrix, which seems to underlie all of this. And it's fascinating how it all interconnects.
Well, yes, there is an occult matrix, and we focused on that, and that can kind of give a ominous yet intriguing overview. But underneath that occult matrix, which you could still call it a cult, is infinity. And infinity is a much more positive concept than the occult matrix we were alluding to or referring to in the earlier podcast, because the infinity of existence, to where all of the negativity that might be going on planet Earth or elsewhere could be just like a something inside of God's nose that he wants to pick out.
Right.
She wants to pick out. It is just like a blip on the radar screen. So it's there is one can connect to infinity, and that is, that is a blessing. That is a wonderful thing. So it's like we're all juxtaposed somewhere in the continuum of existence, and how we interface and relate to it is going to be varying, dependent, and hopefully most of us want to have good experiences, pleasant experiences. And this is what the dark room is all about, because it will put you in touch with who you are. Who you are might or might not be a big problem to yourself. It can often be challenging. And you'll know how big of a problem it is by either your reluctance or your inability to get in there.
Yeah.
And there are also some people who may just be breezing along fine. That's okay, too. They may be on their way to the bank to put in a huge deposit and get lots of universal salvation for their experience. The universe is filled with everything. But I think for most people, it would be a great service to themselves to explore this avenue.
Thank you for listening to the Peter Moon Podcast. To purchase Peter's books, visit skybooksusa.com. Also visit Peter's blog, digitalmontauk.com.